This podcast is intended for healthcare professionals outside the United Kingdom and the United States of America only. Welcome to the Medical Insider COPD by Boehring Ingelheim. This year, Boehring Ingelheim is celebrating 100 years in respiratory research. This podcast offers a breath of fresh air to clinicians treating COPD across the globe. My name is Dr. Richard Russell. I'm a consultant chest physician at Lymington New Forest Hospital in the United Kingdom and a senior clinical researcher at the University of Oxford. I'm also the editor-in-chief of the International Journal of COPD. I'm delighted to be your moderating host for this season of Medical Insider COPD podcast series, and I'm here to bring you news and insights in COPD right from the source directly to you. So thank you for joining us today. Be sure to subscribe and follow the Medical Insider COPD podcast to ensure you do not miss any of the exciting podcasts in this series and indeed the ones we've already recorded. Today, we're going to delve into a publication which I believe is well worth reading with the title of Personal Exposure to Air Pollution and Respiratory Health of COPD Patients in London, the COPE Study. This has just been published in the European Respiratory Journal. We're also going to look at an important topic in social media, looking at how COPD patients are now responding after the COVID pandemic. But first, and most importantly, I'm absolutely delighted to introduce today's guest, who'll be here with me today to discuss the topic of bronchiectasis in the context of COPD. So welcome, Professor James Chalmers. Hello, James.
Hi, Richard. Lovely to be here. My name's James Chalmers, and I'm the British Lung Foundation Chair of Respiratory Research at the University of Dundee, and it's a pleasure to have this opportunity to talk to you about the interaction between COPD and bronchiectasis.
Thank you, James. It's great to have you on again on this podcast series, and we look forward to welcoming you again in the future. So, James, this is a really important area, and it's an area of growth, actually, at the moment in our understanding of lung disease and COPD particularly. Can you tell us a little bit about the impact of bronchiectasis in the context of COPD?
The first thing to say, Richard, is that bronchiectasis is much more common than most people think it is in patients with COPD. So when studies have been done doing CT scans on large populations of COPD patients, between 10 and as many as 50% of COPD patients have at least some bronchiectasis on a CT scan. And that can be from very widespread radiological disease to very mild bronchiectasis. But that can have a really important clinical impact because patients with COPD who have bronchiectasis coexisting are more likely to have frequent exacerbations. They're more likely to have bacterial infection of the lungs. And so they have a worse prognosis, which means it's really important we identify this coexisting condition so that we can treat it appropriately.
And I suspect it's sometimes important to pull apart the heterogeneity, the differences of the different types of bronchiectasis as well.
COPD in itself is a very heterogeneous disease. When you add bronchiectasis on top of that, it becomes extremely complex. But there are some really important common features to bronchiectasis that allows the primary care physician or the chest physician to identify those patients. The vast majority of patients will have cough with chronic production of sputum. That sputum will often be discolored, and patients will typically have frequent chest infections. And so that constellation of symptoms really helps us to drill down into who's likely to have bronchiectasis.
And James, one of the things that I think is of great concern is that are we seeing more of this, or is it because we're looking for it more, or is it actually occurring more often?
I think it's probably a combination of both, Richard, but it's a really important point. I would say that bronchiectasis is a growing problem. It's gone up 40% in the last 10 years. I think that's a combination of this has been an orphan disease that nobody's really thought about, so we haven't been looking for it. And over the past 10 years, more scanning is being done, more historical underdiagnosis being addressed, so we're picking up those cases that have been there anyway. But I also think we have an aging population, and bronchiectasis is a disease that is associated with older age. So more older people means more bronchiectasis. But there probably is also a genuine increase in the proportion of people with bronchiectasis because of changes in antibiotic use, increases in things like non-tuberculous mycobacteria. So I think it's a complex picture that all leads to a lot more bronchiectasis out there.
So bronchiectasis, we need to be suspicious about if people are coughing up discolored sputum, having recurrent exacerbations. And the diagnostic test is high-resolution CT scanning. Are we doing more CT scans? And is that all we need to do for the diagnosis?
So there is a lot more CT scanning being done, but I'm still seeing patients in my clinic who've had bronchiectasis for 10, 15 years with chronic symptoms, and they've never had a CT scan until somebody's finally twigged and gone, this could be bronchiectasis. So we need to be doing more investigation. We need to be thinking bronchiectasis when we're seeing that patient that comes back every year with a couple of chest infections in the winter. Is this actually bronchiectasis? Because that's not normal. So yeah, I think we're doing more tests and we're more aware of this problem than ever before, but we need to be even more aware because there's still a lot of undiagnosed bronchiectasis out there, in my view.
And I think that leads to another question, which concerns me, James, is that if we delay the diagnosis and assess that presentation quickly enough, is there a risk to this? Is there problems with delays in diagnosis?
Absolutely. So bronchiectasis is a progressive disorder. So the earlier you detect it, the less lung damage the patient will have and the easier the disease is to manage. So in the early stages of the disease, you can achieve good control of the condition and improvements in quality of life by just teaching good airway clearance. The physiotherapists are absolutely critical to the management of those patients. But once you've got a patient who's got reduced lung function, chronically infected with Pseudomonas aeruginosa, having frequent exacerbations because their disease has gone on untreated for longer, that becomes much more difficult to manage. These patients often require frequent courses of intravenous antibiotics, home inhaled antibiotics, for example. These become extremely difficult patients to manage. So the best management is early diagnosis and early intervention and intensive work from our physio colleagues in order to avoid us seeing those patients with really severe disease at a late stage.
Okay, let's get a bit technical and scientific for a moment and talk about the pathophysiology and maybe etiology of these diseases together. We know in COPD, there are different phenotypes of COPD, neutrophilic, eosinophilic, for example, just take those that we can find in the sputum. What about bronchiectasis and how does that cross over with COPD?
Very, very similar from an inflammatory perspective. Now, if you look in any textbook, it will tell you that bronchiectasis is a neutrophilic disease. And that's true. So in the vast majority of patients, you look down the microscope, you'll see lots of neutrophils. But that's also true in COPD. Just like in COPD, there is a subset of patients with bronchiectasis who have eosinophilic inflammation. And we know that eosinophilic inflammation can cause bronchiectasis and contribute to bronchiectasis because there's a disease called allergic bronchopulmonary aspergillosis, which is one of the most common causes. And that's an eosinophil-driven disease linked to asthma. So just like COPD, inflammation in bronchiectasis is heterogeneous. And so we can't just put everybody in a box, mark bronchiectasis, and say they need physio and antibiotics. We do have to think about what's going on from a pathophysiological perspective. That's why one of the first things we do with a bronchiectasis patient, along with teaching them physio, is check their immunoglobulins, check their IgE, check that they don't have other underlying conditions that have caused their bronchiectasis.
And James, to better understand this, and I think clearly there is a need for more research and understanding of these two diseases together, is this being taken forward? Well, this is one of your main research areas. And is there new research being done in bronchiectasis and COPD together?
So bronchiectasis historically has been a neglected disease. Indeed, it was described by the European Respiratory Society White Book as the most neglected disease in respiratory medicine as recently as 10 years ago. But recognizing that there's a big unmet need in this disease, there's been an explosion in research in the past 10 years, and there's now a lot more known about the disease, and a lot more needs to be known about the disease. We still have very few proven effective treatments. And so I'm delighted that there are now a number of early phase and late phase clinical development programs starting in bronchiectasis, including bronchiectasis and COPD. And I'm particularly pleased that personally, I'm working with Boehringer Ingelheim on a development program for new therapies for bronchiectasis. It's fantastic that large pharmaceutical companies have recognized the unmet need and are now answering that challenge by trying to develop new drugs.
And that's really exciting because I guess that will also have potentially crossover benefits for different phenotypes of COPD and indeed perhaps asthma as well going forward, which is going to be great.
I very much subscribe to the idea that disease labels are not very helpful. So there's huge crossover between asthma, COPD and bronchiectasis. So when I'm thinking about developing therapies for bronchiectasis, those therapies, if they target inflammatory pathways or they target bacteria, are very likely to also be useful in other airways diseases because the pathophysiology is so closely linked. So we have a lot to learn as people interested in bronchiectasis from COPD and asthma researchers and vice versa.
I think we also should look at this as a multi-morbidity approach, really, as you're just suggesting, because there's also links with bronchiectasis and other diseases such as vascular disease.
Yeah, so a good way of thinking about this is diseases of accelerated aging. So your airways with bronchiectasis are widened. If you actually just look at airways in the healthy population without symptoms, the airways get wider as you get older. So you can view bronchiectasis as a manifestation of accelerated aging. And what else comes with aging? You get vascular disease, you get endothelial dysfunction, you get emphysema. All of those are things that we see in our patients. So it's not surprising that along with our COPD and along with our bronchiectasis, we have other manifestations of aging such as vascular disease. It's important to look for those, and we systematically do that in our bronchiectasis clinic.
Something else we must systematically do, and is often forgotten by all of us, is checking the sputum and looking at the microbiome, looking at actually the bacterial and indeed sometimes viral environment that actually we find in the lungs. James, what should we be doing with looking at the microbiome in people who've got COPD and bronchiectasis?
So you can have some really simple takeaways from this with regard to COPD and bronchiectasis. One is about physio, and we've already touched on that, which is the problem in this disease is impaired airway clearance. And so you've got to enhance airway clearance. But the second is about the bugs. Sputum cultures are so useful in COPD and bronchiectasis. If you send a sputum culture while somebody's clinically stable, it tells you whether they're colonized, infected with bacteria. So it tells you what to treat them with the next time they get an exacerbation. If they're having frequent exacerbations, it helps you to target therapy, and it helps you to identify bugs like Pseudomonas aeruginosa, which need a very specific, different treatment. And if you don't send the sputum, you'll never know what's going on in there. So my practice for my bronchiectasis patients is to send a sputum when they're well at least once a year, and to always try and send a sputum sample when they're starting an antibiotic for an exacerbation.
And the two bugs I certainly look out for, James, which I think are important from a treatment and potentially prognosis point of view, a non-type of Haemophilus and also Pseudomonas. Could you comment on other bugs or how we should look at those two particular bacteria?
So Pseudomonas is very special. So Pseudomonas is associated with a threefold increased risk of death, a sevenfold increased risk of hospitalization. You identify Pseudomonas in a patient with bronchiectasis. If they're not currently under secondary care management, I want to see that person because they have a poor prognosis. So don't just ignore it. It needs to be dealt with. If they're under secondary care management, we try and eradicate that, and we initiate specific therapies such as macrolides or long-term antibiotics in order to reduce the burden of disease. Non-typable Haemophilus is the most common bug that we see in the UK in bronchiectasis patients. It's also the most common bug that we see in COPD. It's associated with a neutrophilic phenotype. It's associated with more exacerbations. It makes you start thinking about the importance of optimizing airway clearance, but also bronchodilator therapy, particularly if they're frequently exacerbating. I have good experience with using long-term azithromycin in that population, whether the label is COPD or bronchiectasis.
We've beautifully segued here into talking about treatments, which is really important. James, inhaled therapies are very much the cornerstones of what we use in airways disease. Do they have a role in bronchiectasis and bronchiectasis COPD crossover type disease? And where should we be cautious, particularly perhaps with the role of inhaled corticosteroids?
So really important point. So the ERS guidelines for bronchiectasis suggest the use of long-acting bronchodilators in patients that have significant breathlessness, and that's my practice as well. So bronchiectasis, like COPD, the most common lung function abnormality is airflow obstruction. The best treatment for airflow obstruction is dual bronchodilators. And so we use that routinely in our patients that have significant breathlessness. Also important to emphasize pulmonary rehabilitation, which is the cornerstone of management of breathlessness in patients with COPD, has been shown to be at least as effective in patients with bronchiectasis. So if you've got a patient with overlap or you've got a patient with primary bronchiectasis, they will benefit from pulmonary rehabilitation just the same way your COPD patients will. So now to the question of inhaled steroid. As I've said, the majority of patients with bronchiectasis are neutrophilic. We know that's a type of inflammation that doesn't respond to inhaled steroid. So the ERS guidelines suggest to avoid inhaled steroid in people with bronchiectasis. So if you have a patient who isn't eosinophilic, they don't have asthma, and they've got COPD bronchiectasis overlap, the best management for that patient is going to be dual bronchodilator, pulmonary rehabilitation, and then thinking about if they've got airway infection, antibiotics and avoiding the inhaled steroid, which some data suggests may even promote overgrowth of bacteria.
Thank you, James. That's really very clear. In a moment, we're going to come on to discuss this important paper from the latest edition of the European Respiratory Journal. Before we do that, though, James, I'm going to put you on the spot. Can you give us a couple of key takeaways for clinicians and also maybe secondary care physicians who are thinking about some research into bronchiectasis? What do they need to do?
So I think in clinical care, think bronchiectasis, because we still don't diagnose it enough or early enough. So think bronchiectasis, do the HRCT scan, which is the diagnostic test. If you diagnose bronchiectasis, look for why the patient's got it. Teach the patient airway clearance. Our physio colleagues are the key part of the management of bronchiectasis. And then adopt the treatable traits approach. Look for what's driving exacerbations and prevent exacerbations because they're what drives disease progression. In terms of research, there's a huge amount needs to be done in bronchiectasis. We don't have an evidence base for the majority of the things that we give in clinical practice. So get involved in bronchiectasis research, enroll your patients into clinical studies, and let's work together to try and develop anti-inflammatory therapies and antimicrobial therapies that can really help our patients.
Professor James Chalmers, thank you very much for joining us today on the podcast. It's been a pleasure as usual.
Thanks, Richard. It's been a real pleasure.
In just a minute, I'm going to talk to you about a hot topic in social media for COPD patients. That is, how are they responding to the post-pandemic world? But first, I want to unpack for you a really important and new paper. It's entitled Personal Exposure to Air Pollution and Respiratory Health of COPD Patients in London, the COPE Study. This was published in the European Respiratory Journal, 2021, Volume 58, Issue 1. The author is Dimitris Evangelopoulos et al., a group from Imperial College. The background to this study is that we have much evidence epidemiologically that health pollution is linked to COPD, both prognosis, also prevalence, incidence, and also rate of acute exacerbations. But no one has ever done before a comprehensive, scaled, longitudinal assessment of air pollution and COPD. So this group have now done that. They looked at 115 patients in London and followed them for up to 128 days individually, with special personalized monitors which measured temperature, nitrogen dioxide, nitric oxide, ozone, and carbon monoxide, as well as particulate pollution, PM 2.5 to 10 microns, and also measured peak flows and symptom scores. They collected data every minute, so this is really granular, which is one of the great strengths of this paper. They had data from over 14,700 patient days to analyze. So what were their results? Gaseous pollutants were strongly associated with a reduction in health in COPD patients. Rates of exacerbations were increased by 16% by levels of increased nitrogen dioxide, by 9% for nitric oxide and 7% for carbon monoxide. These gases were also associated with increases in symptoms of cough and sputum production. So what does this mean? Well, this is now strong evidence in support of clean air campaigns. We know irrefutably now that these gases, which are produced by fossil fuel burning, are associated with worse lung health in COPD patients. And so we would encourage local authorities and governments wherever to campaign for clean air and to drive through litigation, which will help. Let's now talk about the hot topic on social media for our COPD patients. This, again, is dominated by COVID. Our patients are now looking forward. They're asking what next. They're getting into the post-COVID period and wondering what their response should be. There's no doubt from looking at Twitter that our patients are afraid, isolated, and in some cases agoraphobic, and are looking for help. But what's really interesting is much of their help is coming from themselves, and we as healthcare practitioners need to help them with this. They're also getting very excited and engaged with vaccination programs, not only COVID vaccination programs, but also flu and pneumococcal programs. This is being supported in general by everyone in social media, COPD patient groups such as the British Lung Foundation and the COPD Foundation from the United States of America are pushing this very hard. There are some concerns about vaccination, particularly the COVID vaccine in COPD, but again, these are being robustly pushed back by both healthcare practitioners and also patients themselves. What else are patients doing? Patients are doing more exercise with programs such as Stronger for Summer, and also fit for winter campaigns. This is being driven right the way across Western Europe and indeed the world. Getting ready for the winter is certainly something our patients are concerned about. This is being driven and helped by videos and also by visual aids. There was also a very interesting thing on the COPD Foundation website looking at how patients with COPD are becoming stressed in the post-COVID period. And actually, the COPD Foundation are providing globally for free yoga sessions, which again, our patients can be encouraged to tap into, which will help. So I hope you've enjoyed today's Medical Insider COPD podcast. We looked at the important clinical topic of bronchiectasis and COPD. Then we moved on to this important and new paper looking at the air pollution effects on COPD, both its prevalence of exacerbations and also symptoms. Please have a read of that. And then finally, we looked at social media and how patients are responding in the post-COVID period. And it's our job as healthcare practitioners to get them ready, to get them fit, and to treat them in the best way possible going forward. I hope you've enjoyed today's podcast, and please look out for the future podcasts and join us there too.